Welcome to The Dynamics Hot Dish, the podcast where Ashley Steiner, Allie Nelson, and Liz McLennan dish up the latest news and insights about dynamics in the Power Platform. Join us to explore business applications and low-code development with tips, tricks, and real-world experiences. So grab a seat at the table and let's dig in.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Dynamics Hot Dish. We have a very special guest with us here this week. We have Neil Benson, who's the co-founder of Superware and owner of Customary. Welcome, Neil. If you want to give yourself a brief introduction.
Thanks, Ali. Hi, Ashley. It's great to be with you both. Ali, we had the privilege of meeting for the first time in person at the Power Platform Conference in Vegas last week. It was great to see you there. Ashley, I missed you.
A lot of people did.
Maybe next time. Yeah. So thanks for the introduction. I'm Neil. I live in Brisbane, Australia. I run Superware, which is an ISV building Microsoft business apps for the superannuation industry here in Australia. And then Customary, which is a business that helps Microsoft customers and partners build amazing applications using agile approaches like Scrum. And I've been building business apps for such a long time, probably 15 or 20 years by now. And it's a pleasure to finally join you on the Dynamics Hot Dish. I've been a long time listener, and congratulations on your 100th episode recently. Well done.
Oh, thank you. I know we've been talking forever. I feel like, Neil, it's been, I know I said like it was a year and a half. I can't believe it's been 2.5 years, but we've been talking forever about bringing you on. And I'm so excited that we finally were like, no, we're pulling the trigger. We know what we want Neil to talk about. We're bringing him on because I feel like you've been in our hopper forever, Neil, about wanting to bring you on. So I'm really excited about this.
Me too.
And not to mention that, you know, with your last comment too about Customary and Agile, that's exactly why we brought you on. And we recorded our Azure DevOps series recently, as many of the listeners know. And Neil actually reached out to us and said, I do things differently than you guys do. And we said, great, we would love to hear your perspectives on, you know, things that you do differently, things that you've found that work a little bit better. And I, even from emailing with you recently, I always pick up on the tagline in your email of like, keep experimenting. So I know that you're going to give us some information based off of like real life experiments you've done to figure out what works best. So we're really excited to hear what you have to share with us and our listeners today.
Yeah. Thanks, Ali. Yeah, you're right. I changed my tagline. I used to keep sprinting, but that sounds like really hard work to, you know, if anybody's been on a long running Scrum team and you do one sprint after another, that's, you know, to keep sprinting, it's exhausting. So I changed it. Now I keep experimenting. And that's really because at the heart of agile approaches is this idea of empiricism, that you can't know everything up front. You can't know all your requirements. You can't know exactly what the technical design is going to look like. And you can't know all the working practices your team will need to adopt in order to build the applications. You have to figure it out as you go along. And you do that by experimenting. You have a hypothesis and you test it out and you see what the results look like and you keep doing it or you abandon it and try something else. So yeah, that's why we changed.
And I love it because that relates to what all of us do. I mean, even whenever we start a new project with a new client, you're with different teammates, you're doing things a little bit differently. So really we may start in one direction and think, okay, this is not working. You know, the customer isn't adapting to this. Our team isn't working with this. How can we change? Right. So experimenting is a big part of what we do every day.
Yeah. And it's something I've changed my language. I used to say, you know, these are best practices. But what I found is that that was a best practice at that moment in time for that team with that customer in that environment. But this is a different situation we find ourselves in. And so that practice may not be the best practice today. And it still might be a good practice, a proven practice. But I want to use the word better practices because there might be something better than the best practice. We just haven't uncovered it yet.
I love it. Thank you. Okay. Well, yeah. On that note too. So what we were talking about right before this is our Azure DevOps best practices. And what we're learning is there may be some better practices out there. So that's a fantastic segue. So Neil, I'll just ask you, what stood out first in that episode to you that you've experimented with and you found that might work better based off of your experiences?
Yeah. So the first one of your best practices that tripped me up was using tasks in our agile practice. So we have user stories or product backlog items. Most of the product backlog items we write are user stories. And is it necessary to break those down into smaller tasks? I used to do that for first 5 or 6 years. I was practicing Scrum. And then on a project in around 2014 or 15, at Advantage Solutions in California, we found that a lot of our tasks were analyze the requirement, design the solution, develop the component, test it, deploy it. Like, oh, that's just a mini waterfall. And so we had, for every user story, we had these five or six very repetitive tasks. I think this is a waste of time. We'd estimate them in hours. We'd estimate the story normally in story points. Then we'd estimate the tasks in hours or days. And it just felt like a lot of time spent estimating and tracking all of that. And we did some research, and there was one of the signatories of the Agile Manifesto went to work for Rally Software. He looked at all these teams using tasks and all the teams not using tasks. And what he uncovered in all the data was that teams that don't use tasks are actually more productive. They deliver more work than teams that do. So I thought, that's interesting. Let's experiment. We dropped tasks. So now we have the columns on our Scrum board, and we just move the user story from left to right through the different stages of, you know, from not done to done. And it's worked really well. It's far less time spent writing and breaking things down into tasks, less time spent estimating, less time spent time recording, and we seem to get more work done and have just as good transparency and visibility of our work. What do you think? Could that work for you?
Yeah, I have tons of questions, right? Because I guess I've only worked
me too.
In the agile way where you do track tasks, right? And I've used them very differently than what you said, like the build, test, deploy. You know, I've used tasks to say, okay, as a user, I want to be able to do X. Like, this is the thing I need to be able to do. And in my tasks, I say, okay, like, first, you always have to like do some sort of requirements gathering, like what is like the end goal, things like that. But then then once I have the solution in my mind, then I break that up into tasks. So is it like creating fields? Is it creating views? Is it creating a power app? And what, you know, maybe that's a new user story, you know, things like that. So I use the tasks to kind of break up the work, and then tracking how much time those, you know, activities are going to take me, so that we know how to estimate things in the future, I guess, is the way that I use that time, because I want to know if I'm going to do this same thing again for another customer in 6 months, how much should I estimate, you know, are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Depending, you know, let's take our worst resource and estimate everything on them, right? Because, you know, you don't want to estimate everything on your best resource. Otherwise you're never going to make any money. So I guess that's the way I've used tasks, is to kind of break down the different pieces. And then even having user stories assigned to different people, because different people might be taking on different tasks. Allie, what about, do you want to respond to that, Neil, before I throw it over to Allie?
Let me touch on that last part.
Not on too much. We'll go one at a time.
So I was in a debate recently on one of the Microsoft community boards about Azure DevOps. One feature it's lacking, I can't remember what it's called, like the owner field, like who is this product backlog item owned by or assigned to, whatever the label is. And I wish that was a multi-user field, because in my teams, what we tend to do today, because it's a single user field, we change the owner quite frequently. It starts out with a developer who's maybe the analyst in the team, and then it gets passed over to one of the developers, maybe another developer, and then the tester, and then it's done. What I wish we could do is have multiple users in there, because the story tends to start out with the product owner, or maybe a super user who's raised the requirement, or business analyst who's done some refinement on it. And then we start development, and it might be usually one, but maybe a couple of developers working in that story, and then a tester who verifies it. And I wish I could put all their names. So we have this little, what we call three amigos. It's usually an analyst, a developer, and a tester. The three amigos who are working on that story collectively within our Scrum team. And we can't do that with Azure DevOps. We can do it with Jira, but let's not mention that. So tasks do give you that flexibility, because now you can break your product backlog item down into tasks, and you can have different people working on that product backlog item, because there's different tasks assigned to different people. So you got me there. Other than that, I still don't like using tasks.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Allie.
Ashley, you promised I get the next question.
I know. I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
No, I knew we'd have tons of questions for you, Neil, so be prepared. No, but along those same lines, that's exactly what I use user stories for as well, is I'm typically the analyst on it, right? Or the product owner. So I'm usually the person writing out the user story. I will say I'm a fan of having both business and technical information in user stories. That's one thing that I like to do. So I like to say, you know, as a salesperson, I need to be able to do this so that I can do this because blah, 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 blah. But then I also like to do like my wireframes or mockups or just detailed information in the user story as well to get a whole picture of everything that I'm envisioning. But then what I use the tasks for is doling out the work to different people. So if someone else is going to build it, I would say, you know, here, you create these fields, you create these tables, you put those fields on this form, kind of. And that way I can keep track of everybody who's supposed to do those tasks and see where they're at. So that's the one thing that comes to mind for me.
Oh, that sounds very project manager-y. Like you get a task and you get a task and you get a task. Like not an Oprah Winfrey kind of, you get a car kind of way, but you know, this is, I think the best teams are self-managing, self-organizing, and they pool the work. And you talked about that in your best practices episode, where developers get to pool the work rather than work being pushed onto the developer. So I'd say try not using tasks and let the developers figure out who's going to do the work. And that's what we have daily scrums for. And, you know, we can let them figure it out themselves.
Yeah, Ali, that sounds really controlling. We don't do it that way. We go pick our user stories and then create the tasks for ourselves. Like, how do we want to break up the work? And then, oh, if I can't do this task, hey, I can't do this task, who can? Kind of thing.
So, right. And I think part of it too is dealing with like more junior employees of like, that's kind of where I'm usually at, is like trying to tell them what needs to happen and then helping them document it in that way. So to be fair, I probably wouldn't do the same thing for like a super senior consultant.
Got it. So it does sound like there's different practices that can be used based on your resources as well, right? Would you agree with that?
For sure.
Like in Ali's situation, you know, asking a junior resource to know and understand the work well enough to go pick out of a pool might be a little bit daunting.
And so that's why we definitely work in these little amigos groups where we wouldn't necessarily leave a junior resource or junior team member to do the user story on their own. They'd be paired up with somebody. And even if that mentor is just there as a sounding board, hey, look, I'm thinking about using a flow. Oh, I wouldn't use a flow because it needs to be real time. I'd use this, you know, those kind of ideas and bouncing off people. I wouldn't use tasks and prescribe to them how it should be done. I want them to learn how to design components themselves, and giving them some latitude is what I find to be a nice way to do that, rather than prescribing it for them.
I think that's totally a fair point, because sometimes I have just tried to like, trying to keep track of everything that everyone's supposed to do, right? I have done tasks in the past of like, hey, I need this done. Can you tell me if this should be JavaScript? Can you tell me if this should be a workflow? Can you tell me how this? So it's like, it kind of, by making those self-organizing teams, it eliminates that, right? Because I'm saying like, I don't know what the best way is. I want you to do this, but really maybe it should just fall back on the user story. And then by just assigning that user story to them, they know that that's their job.
Yeah. There's a real temptation, especially for product owners who are more technically inclined and know the difference between JavaScript and a business rule, to want to know or tell people what the solutions should look like. And I think I just trust my developers to come up with the best solution. And they might have to change it like halfway through the user story. They might get so far, and then as a new requirement comes up or a new acceptance criterion, and we got to change the design. So I just let them handle it. Trust them to come up with an awesome technical implementation.
It sounds very relaxed. Because I don't want to say like, I know that my team is going to listen to this, right? And I work with the same project manager. We have one project manager that does all of our dynamics, and he's going to listen to this and be like, oh my gosh, you think I'm controlling and I'm telling everyone what to do. But I mean, we use tasks to estimate time. And then like, how well did we do to that estimate on the actual? I would say that's probably the biggest reason.
Ashley, that is why I hate tasks the most. That's my beef with tasks, is because I've been like, when I was at CHS and with my team there, we were trying to get told from the project managers or delivery managers, like, put your hours on the tasks. I need to know the burn down. I need to know this. And the developers are always like, I got to enter my time sheet. Now you're telling me I got to put my time on the task. Like, how many times do you want me to record me for that?
So
yeah, I'm one of those delivery managers that cares what people are spending their time on.
Can I share what my teams do for tracking time?
Please.
So typically, most of them are full-time, assigned full-time to a given customer's project. And this is as a Microsoft partner. If you're a Microsoft customer running an internal team, it might be slightly differently. But we love it when we've got a nice, stable team that are full-time on one project. That's the gold standard or a great practice. It's not always possible, but that's what we love. And then when I turn in my timesheet, it just says 40 hours for this project this week, like 8 hours per day. So there's 5 time entries to do, typically 8, 8, 8, 8, 8. And that's it, done. I don't track time spent on tasks. We don't estimate tasks in hours. We estimate user stories and story points, and that's it. We track our burn down as the number of points completed per day. So we do have a burn down if you find that metric useful. But the whole time recording, oh my goodness, Ali, I heard you on the best practices episode and people recording their time twice. And I said, oh my Lord, who wants to be bothered with all of that?
I die on how I have to record my time, Neil. I have to go down to like sometimes the 15 minute mark to like this task versus this task. Because we use timekeeping in product operations, and we use it the way that you're describing this, I always thought we were super agile, and I'm like, oh, the amount of time that I spend entering my time, I could be like doing all this other work.
Do you know what?
For time entry.
I was going to say, whenever I was tracking my time in that detail, we had to have a time code, which is time spent recording time. Oh, yuck. That's crazy.
Have you found that people really want that granularity, though? Like, if you're working for, you know, a customer, an end user, do you find that they want that granularity to know where your time is going? Like, how would you get away from that if that happens?
So it does require a lot of trust between us as a delivery partner and the Microsoft customer. And that trust comes with time. So I don't track that time, but, you know, it develops over the course of a couple of sprints when they can see the quality of the product that we're building right in front of them. And then when we, you know, after we typically turn in an invoice after each sprint, and it's just got the names of all the team members, how many hours they spent on their product in that sprint. And I compare that against the forecast. So whenever I forecast the cost of a sprint, let's say it was a team of 6, they're going to do 40 hours per week. So it's 80 hours per sprint because it's typically a 2-week sprint. So I forecast that there'll be 95% devoted to that customer's project because people take time off, there's public holidays and whatever else. And so we've got a forecast. The average cost of each sprint is going to be, you know, $75,000. The actual cost of this sprint was $72,000. The next one might be $80,000. But on average, we should be right around there. So they now have a budget. Going to do 10 sprints, that's $750,000. And we can track as each invoice gets submitted, you know, are we ahead of budget or behind budget? And that's sufficient. They don't care if Ali spent, you know, 4 hours and 15 minutes on this given tasks. They care about the quality of the feature, not much time was necessarily spent on it. Yeah. Do you think you could get your clients?
Yeah, I want your customers. I think, but I agree with you. I think that there is that level of trust. And I think that a lot of that starts with sales, because one of the things that I've really worked on is educating sales teams on this whole agile process. They're like, well, what's the deliverable? And I'm like, I don't know yet. Like, we haven't done the requirements. We haven't done what I call a sprint zero to kind of even just start to build the backlog of, you know, what are the user stories and the dream and the wish. And I was like, I have no idea. The deliverable is they're going to have something awesome and it's going to solve the problem that they have. But I have no idea what that's going to look like. No, we could do an SOW sprint by sprint by sprint. But I mean, it kind of takes away then the flexibility to adjust and adapt. And so, yeah, I think a lot of that goes back to how you sell and how you communicate to the customer, what that process is going to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've trained hundreds of business apps people in Scrum, and they've got the Scrum certification. The number one question I got, which is quite a surprise, I thought it'd be, you know, how do I use user stories or how do I record my time? But the number one question I got was, how do we get our salespeople to sell this, to sell our job project?
I'm actually not surprised by that, the way that I've seen salespeople try to sell an agile project.
Right. And so I have a masterclass that does exactly that, pre-sales, practice leaders, project managers, business development folks, on how to sell and win agile projects. The statement of work has to be completely different. The contract with the customer has to be quite different. the way that we estimate and set expectations up front has to be quite different. Otherwise, you're just back into a world of hurt, of very detailed statements of work with requirement specifications that are set in concrete and, minutia time tracking. Yeah.
Well, I agree, because you get yourself into these like, my company's going to kill me, but I got into this, one recently where you had to build like a matrix of like risk and things like that. And I'm like, but we don't know. Like, we don't know what the risk of this is because we haven't built anything to even validate if what kind of tool we could use to, it's so hard in this, like, yeah, okay. Like 10 years ago on a water file, we could have sat in a room for 10 months and built this. And I could have told you exactly the way that the tool is going to be in 10 months, because we're not going to adopt anything new.
Right.
But I mean, the power platform and dynamics are ever changing, right? What I'm doing today, Microsoft could say in 4 weeks, oh, hey, by the way, I'm changing everything to real-time marketing. And that outbound email that you're sending is no longer even available. So, it's you got to be flexible and be able to move with it.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're absolutely right. At the Power Platform conference, I attended Marilyn's one-day marketing workshop. She had to change the name of the workshop right at the last minute. And then Vivian did another marketing workshop, and she had to change the name of that one as well. And then things change. There's lots of new stuff coming as well. So if you design a solution up front, you may not be able to make use of copilots because they weren't available whenever you did the design 10 months ago.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Not to mention like the user side of it too. But when you start getting users in the platform, they start knowing more about it and the way they request things changes.
Yes.
Right? So if you try to get everything from them at the beginning of a project and say, everything you tell me is this is how it's going to be, then when they get hands-on, they're going to start wanting things changed and moved around because now they know what options they have. And it's really hard to say like, oh, sorry, that's not in your statement of work, or we ran out of time. We don't have time to do that. So there's
that. I call that capturing requirements at the point of peak ignorance. When my team knows the least about the customer's business, like right at the very first sprint, like we just met, here we go. We know very little about your organization, its culture, its existing systems, the quality of the data, what features you need. Sure, we've done some kind of discovery in pre-sales, but this is it. This is delivery day one. And as a bunch of users, you know least about the Power Platform. You're going to know more every single sprint. So let's defer requirements analysis until the last possible moment, which is when we're just about to build the feature, because then we'll know a lot more. We'll all know a lot more.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I like that, because you're right. I mean, even as you start to build a backlog, I mean, things might change, or they'll say, oh, hey, we didn't know that this was available over here. And that resolves all of these different things that we were looking for the tool to do. And we can just do it with this one feature functionality that has been released.
Right.
Yeah, that one, this is all hitting home. I love these kind of conversations that make me go back and rethink everything I'm doing.
Oh dear, sounds very existential.
Yeah, that's my whole life.
Have I chosen the right career?
Yeah, with my glass of leftover, well, I guess I don't have that champagne anymore, but with my glass of wine tonight, I'll be sitting
Cheers.
Wondering if I need to make different decisions. So Neil, something we were talking about before we started the cameras was talking about how, when we have too much work in a sprint, what do? When you continuously have, we've all been there, right? Where we're like, oh gosh, we're over the points. We've committed to too much. Happens all the time. But when it happens repeatedly, sprint over sprint, you have a problem. And how do you solve that problem? What is your go-to? So I'd love to kind of, I'm going to set you up and then let you talk and just kind of talk about what you've seen and what works and what doesn't work. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. So just to set the scene a little bit about how we forecast in my teams, and this is what I coach other people to do as well. We typically estimate in story points. I love using story points rather than time, and there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. But then we also have to forecast the team's velocity. And we have to do that right before we start the work. We have to set some expectations with the customer. We're going to be able, we think with this size team, given what we know about your environment, we can do 25 points per sprint. And so when we look at the top of the backlog and we select 25 points worth of user stories, we may have bitten off more than we can chew and we end up delivering 15 or 20, something under 25. And those stories that didn't get done go back onto the product backlog. Typically, they roll over to the next sprint because they're still valuable, high priority items. But the product owner can always choose, based on what she's learned, no, we're going to jettison a couple of those, shove them into the middle of the backlog, we'll do something else next sprint. But if that happens sprint over sprint, then either our forecast velocity is too high, we need to lower that, which never goes down well, or we need to find out a way of getting more done during the sprint. And what I've seen some teams react in a couple of different ways to that. They can either extend the sprint and stop doing 2-week sprints, which is what I recommend starting with as an experiment, and they go, well, let's change it to a 3-week sprint, which doesn't really change your velocity problem, but people believe they can get more work done in 3 weeks than they can in 2 weeks, which is probably true, but get fewer sprints in a 6-month period. That's one common reaction. Another one is to defer testing. Oh, let's do the development in sprint one, and we'll test all those things that were done in sprint one in sprint two. Well, that's not really done. The work isn't done until it's been tested and verified. So I don't like deferring the testing. And the other thing that teams can do is to just create smaller stories, split them up into more manageable user stories. And that I find has been the most successful way of reacting to overcommitment. But there's one of my project managers recently said, we were reflecting on the Scrum values, and he said he just joined our team, and we'd worked with him before, but he just rejoined. And he said, I think you're too courageous. So courage is one of Scrum's values, but our team was being too courageous when forecasting how much work we could get done during a sprint. Like, our forecast is 25, but we are accepting and forecasting 30. Why? Why do we do that? It's pretty unrealistic. And so that was a bad pattern that we'd slipped into, was trying to rush through the work, and yeah, we'd fall short.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what your teams have done to try and track the velocity, stay on forecast, and get plenty of work done.
Yeah, I think that the obvious one is going from a 2 to a 3 week sprint. So that's what we did, is we found that just 2 week sprints, our clients couldn't keep up with it. In addition to us, it just was like you get whiplash, like you're just moving so fast. There wasn't enough time for them to test. So we did add that third week for testing. And I think where I still struggle is then where do you do your go live as part of that? Because, okay, we've added in this third week to help, you know, the whiplash and help with testing, but like you still have to go live at some point. Especially because I understand, like, you know, when, if you're working on an implementation, you might have these 2-3 week sprints, you know, for a few months before you, but I mean, if you're doing an ongoing implementation and you're just like, okay, here are the enhancements we're going to make over the next 6 months, you know, that kind of thing, we're keeping the system up and running,
right.
You know, you have to push things into production as you go. So that's one of the things that I struggle with, is because you can't sell a customer on, okay, it's going to be 2 story points to push all this to production, because it takes time. So where do you put that into the sprint that it does take time to do that, but you can't take it? Yeah, I struggle with that still, I'll admit.
Ali, how have you found it?
Yeah, so I think I've never extended sprints. Well, I shouldn't say that. So usually it takes a little bit of time to figure out what the sprint cadence will work for you and your client. And actually, like you said, sometimes 2 weeks is just way too quick for clients, you know, especially when you're doing sales implementations, when you need salespeople and they tend to be on the go a lot, it's really hard to nail them down sometimes in those 2 week periods consistently. So then you end up going for a little bit longer simply because your testers and people that you need to help you validate the work are not available more frequently than that. But then you're still doing like a smaller amount of story points, just extended out a little bit longer because that's what your client needs, right? So what we've done is like I've lowered points that you can do in sprints, and just saying like, okay, let's try to bite off more, but in smaller quantities. So really bite-sized stories is what we'll go with. So it's like, and who doesn't love checking off work? Right. So like stories that last way too long, it's kind of disheartening. It's like, why can't I get this done? It just keeps carrying forward. And I like checking them off. I like moving that button to resolved or closed or whatever your last status is and saying, I'm done with this. So smaller user stories, maybe with or without tasks, but smaller user stories, I'm usually a fan of, because then you can get more people working on them, you can get them out the door faster, and you can see your list going down. And I think that's just a really good feeling.
It's
banned story points over like a certain amount. I don't know what it is because I'm not the PM, but if we like get to a point where we're like, oh gosh, we think it's this many story points, we're like, too big, you know what, let's go back to the drawing table and like even make it smaller, because we're not going to put something at an 8 or, you know, 5, you know, like that's just too large to, I don't know what the number is, I'm making that up, my PM would know what we've outlawed, but yeah, so I mean, because at some point, like you can't just have a one story take 2.5 weeks on a 3-week sprint.
Yeah, that's you just reminded me about coming back from the US to Australia, and I'm driving along the road. You should switch to the metric system, because in the same distance, we call it 100 kilometers and you call it 60 miles. Wow, 100 kilometers an hour feels a lot faster. You go past the kilometers really quickly compared to miles. So it just working in smaller user stories, it feels the same. I love your practice, actually, of setting a limit on the biggest user story that you'll accept into your sprint backlog. For my teams, we estimate in 1, 2, 3, 5, and 8. As user stories, anything bigger than 8, so 13, 20, 40, 60 are features or epics. And we have those in the backlog. They're, you know, in the middle or the bottom of the backlog, and we haven't refined them and broken them down yet. But as they get closer, we'll break them up. And even an 8-point story we find is risky. There's a lot of uncertainty in it. And in a 2-week sprint, development of that 8-point story is likely to happen in the last couple of days of the sprint. And put the testers out, they're going to have to test a big story right at the end of the sprint, and that's really tough. So if it's going to be in the sprint backlog, try and keep it 1, 2, 3, or 5, and if it's a bigger user story, start it day one. Don't wait until the middle of the sprint to start it, and start those big ones right at the start of the sprint. And if you can, if you've got multiple developers in your team, have them all start different stories of different sizes, so that there's a nice flow coming through to the testers and the super users to validate. Don't leave them all, you know, if everybody starts a big 5-point story, then everything seems to get done in the middle of the end of the sprint. So we want that continuous flow coming through. Yeah.
How do you determine when to, or do you ever stop development in a sprint so testing can get caught up, so testing doesn't flow from sprint to sprint on old user stories? How do you just manage?
Well, there's a couple of levers you need to pull, right? You need to have sufficient analysis, so there's a good flow of stories coming to the developers. You need to have enough developers, not too many, so that the number of testers and developers is balanced, so you can test and validate everything that's being developed. So those are kind of three different skill sets you need to balance in your team. And certainly if there's more stories coming through than you can test, then you either need to switch it up and take a developer off and replace them with a tester, or temporarily have one of the developers do some testing. While the testers are testing, the developers have still got plenty of work to do. We do their documentation, we're deploying stuff to go live, we're improving our pipelines, we're, you know, reducing technical debt. So there's lots of work that can be done while the testers are testing in that sprint. I love getting testing done in the sprint and not pushing it into a later sprint.
I'm with you there.
So unresolved. Like if something is not tested and marked as like, this is approved and ready to go, I feel like I've left baggage behind. Yes.
Well, not to mention, what if there's a bug, right? And then now suddenly you're pulling that user story forward so you can fix the bug on it, and then it has to go back to testing. And then you have this user story that's floating along kind of through all of your sprints, right, and never is actually fully resolved.
Yeah. And it's hard if you're a developer, like, oh, I built that feature 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. Let me go and open it up again. I can't remember what I did. And so you've got this mental shift of having to, you know, put that thing back into your memory, load it back up again, work on it, and then get it out of memory back into the board and do something else. So there's a context switching. Whereas if I worked on it yesterday and I said, look, development's complete, can you test it? And the tester comes back with some feedback. Well, it's still in memory. I know exactly what I did and I can quickly fix it. I don't call it a bug though, Ali, because I think bugs come from production. And so we just say this, the item isn't finished yet. Do you create a bug, like an item in your backlog for that feedback? Or are you just passing this story around the team and tracking its movement across columns?
So yeah. I also only create bugs for production. If it's not working in a lower environment, we just put the user story back into whatever status you call it. But yeah, we just move the user story back.
What do you think? And I would say it totally, it depends, right? And I think on your more waterfall projects I've seen bugs created during development, because unfortunately you get into that situation where it was developed 4 weeks ago, the developer is doing something else, I need to have a mechanism to tell them what to fix. But historically, I've primarily just seen bugs once it's in production as well. Right. Because then it is truly a defect that needs to get addressed. It's like, you know, using categories like, okay, new to development, in QA, and then if it's not approved, goes back to the developer, kind of whatever your statuses are. That's usually what I see more often.
Yeah, me too. Cool.
So Neil, do you solely work your projects in Agile? You do. Are you strict Agile? Are you, my favorite word is Wagile, like a mix of the two? Like, how would you say
Agile
you
fall?
The most success, the Agile fall? How do you find the most success? And would you say that you run like a true Agile shop?
I'd like to think so. There's no perfect test. You know, somebody can't just come in and certify, oh, this team's a perfect Agile team. But yes, we use the Scrum framework for all of our projects. If a prospective customer comes to us and says, hey, look, we want you to use a hybrid approach or a traditional approach, we have the luxury of walking away and saying, nope, we don't work with you. And I appreciate that's a great privilege. A lot of Microsoft partners, and particularly delivery teams, don't get to choose the implementation approach. Pre-sales or their practice manager sets that, and they have to use different approaches with different situations. I've just found that those traditional approaches kill people. You have a death march into production and you're way over budget and testing gets cut and training gets cut and everybody's miserable and it's stressful and horrible and career ending. And I don't like it. I want nice, relaxing, smooth flow of features into production and everybody's happy and customer buys us pizza at the end.
Yeah, I have to say my biggest thing that I hated, I mean, and I'm not going to say we work in a true Agile, because I think a lot of it is you have to educate the customers, right? People are so used to going into a closet for however many months and, oh, we come out with something shiny and pretty at the end. And it's just not, the world doesn't work like that. Like, technology is moving so fast. I mean, think about like ChatGPT. I mean, that thing came out and the entire tech world changed in 24 hours. So I mean, you can't build like that anymore. You have to do things, you know, in an iterative fashion. But my biggest, the thing that like, it would keep me up at night was putting those change requests in front of a customer saying, I cannot finish your project because I have run out of hours and you will not get anything if you don't sign this for 100 more hours or whatever it is. Yeah. Those that used to keep me up at night. And I have to say, one of the things I've really looked for in the you know, I'm as an independent contractor, I'm, you know, mostly working with one company, but I look for that when I work with companies is I don't want to do that. You know, I want to work in a very, you know, collaborative nature where we're coming to something at the end that, you know, it either has no end or, hey, the customer's happy and that's the end. But yeah, so I, man, the sleepless nights I used to have being like, oh, I have to present this, you know, new change request to the customer tomorrow. And I have not had to do that in any sort of Agile style project. Right. So,
yeah.
And not to, you know, what Neil mentioned too of cutting out training, right? As a trainer historically, that was always the most painful part of like, nope, we got to use the budget to get the work done, or yep, we need to use the time to get the work done. And it's like, okay, well, now how are people going to know what to do once you deliver it to them? And that's unfortunately something that, you know, does get cut, and it shouldn't, it definitely shouldn't, but it seems like people prioritize getting the tool over preparing their users for using said tool. So that's always a tough conversation as well.
I don't know how I'm going to get through the rest of today. I took a lot of therapy to get over my change request PTSD. Actually, you've evoked a lot of painful memories. My teams sometimes don't get all the work done that the customer would like to get done. So we have an initial statement of work, and we might need another statement of work to do work. But the difference is that like every single sprint, we have features in production, or customer can choose to put them in production. It's not like we're halfway through development and there's no work finished. There's no application ready to go. And we need a change request to get stuff into production. We're live. We're typically the additional statements of work are for enhancements. Occasionally, they're for unexpected stuff, like data migration always takes longer than you initially anticipated. That's just a given.
Yeah.
Change requests.
It's never there as are... clean as the customer says the data.
No.
It's never.
No.
Sorry, go ahead, Neil.
I think there are some, I don't want to say Microsoft partners, but there are definitely some systems integrators out there who will lowball a fixed price bid and intend to make all the money, all the profit comes from change requests. And so they win that project because they undercut everybody else in the industry. And then the customer just gets nickeled and dimed into profitability through, you know, 1,000 tiny change requests. And it's miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
how it is. Well, I agree with you on the, you know, that original SOW, it might not be what the customer thought it was, but that doesn't mean they don't have anything. And what they have is fully functioning. And, you know, and I think that that's like the biggest thing about Agile that I've noticed is that you might not get what you thought you would, but you have something that solves the problems that you had before.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that's what you're looking for. I'm so sorry to bring up your PTSD, but I also have PTSD from that, like, hey, you have nothing, but we need, you know, $50,000 more to get this even into a state to use something. It's terrible. I like that from an Agile perspective, you at least have something along the way for your customer to use.
And here, I have one more question for you tied to something that you just said before about like moving to production. And, you know, there can be differing opinions on that too, of like, well, do we move stuff into production versus when do users use it? Right. So in my mind, there's always two go lives. There's the move to production and then there's users using it. And the real go live in my mind has always been the users using it.
Yes.
And if you are doing like a brand new implementation and you're doing it in the Agile way, in your experience, has there been times when you might be sticking stuff into production and users aren't using it? Or do you always try to aim for giving them a tangible something that they can use right away?
I think that experience will vary from teams to teams, depending on what type of project or what type of application they're building. My teams are quite often building an enterprise application, replacing an existing system that's already in production. So it's an old CRM system or an old ERP system, or a power, you know, not a power app, but a power builder is one that I'm replacing. We just replaced it this week. And so there's something there that we have to replace. And really, you have to have all the old features in the new application before you can go live. So it's quite a big bang implementation, quite a traditional go live. Once we're there and people have switched over from the old application to the new one, then we do incremental releases quite often. Maybe not every sprint. We have to be sensitive to people's tolerance for change. And so it might be once a quarter, once a month, not a couple of times per sprint. And one practice I've seen, it's getting easier to do in Power Platform, is a feature flag. So we build the feature, we put it into production, but the feature is turned off. A bit like some of the switches you see with some of the experimental features that Microsoft releases. Like a system admin can go in and enable or disable that feature at any time. And so we're trying to do the same thing with our features, our custom features, is to get them into production and the product owner or the system administrator can turn them on when she chooses and when the training has been rolled out, when users are demanding it. But that feature was in production a couple of months ago. It's just a matter of when do we turn it on.
I like that idea. I've never thought to do it like that, but you're right. I mean, Microsoft is moving to that model where, you know, you can opt in when you're ready.
Yeah. And so there's some platform features that make it possible for us to create feature flags as well. Previously, we try and hack our way through it with things like security roles. And we just update your security role. Voila, now you can get access to this new feature. But that wasn't always watertight. So feature flags is a good developer feature to look into.
Very cool. I love that idea. Okay. You asked.
All right, Allie. Oh, me asked?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Neil, we couldn't let you get away without asking you what your favorite hot dish is. And being a listener of the podcast, I'm going to assume that you know what that is. Explain.
Yeah. So as far as I can gather,
thing.
It is an American thing. So it's like a casserole, right? I would call it a casserole. So
yeah,
in Ireland, we have stew. So Irish stew traditionally is a slow cooked lamb, typically a leg of lamb, with potatoes and carrots and onions, and you cook that for hours and hours until everything boils down and it turns thick and creamy, and it's just delicious. And on top of that, we'd add some HP sauce, which is like a spicy, tangy brown sauce, and it is delicious. And that will sustain you all winter on Irish stew. So that's my recommendation for your hot dish.
Okay.
That sounds amazing. I want to eat that now.
Yeah, I've been to Ireland. I did not try Irish stew, but it sounds like
you'll have to go back. If you have a local Irish pub, they should serve it too.
I'm always scared that Americans don't make as good of Irish food. I've watched too much Gordon Ramsay to like think that people in America can make real Irish food. So, but I did have a lamb burger in Ireland, and I was pretty proud of myself for that. I'm not very, I don't experiment with food. So you're experimenting from before. I don't do that with food. Yeah.
Very good.
So that's awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Neil, for coming on. We're so happy to have you, and we'll definitely have you back if you'll have us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Dynamics Hot Dish, your go-to podcast for all things Dynamics 365 and the Power Platform. If you found this episode helpful, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on social media for even more insights and updates on the latest trends and best practices in business applications and low-code development. We'll be back soon with another delicious serving of Dynamics and Power Platform goodness. Until then, keep innovating and building great solutions.